Over 3.5 goals, Bournemouth versus Manchester City. Correct. Timo Pukki to score any time against Chelsea. Correct. Liverpool 3, Arsenal 1. Correct. Son Heung-min to score any time against Newcastle. Incorrect. Ruined. And of course, what I'm referencing is the Squawker Talker Betball Accumulator that we put on last week. 3 out of 4 predictions were correct, but cheers, son. Squawker Talker is crying. And if you've missed any episodes, of course, I am referencing the fact that the Squawker Talker this season is sponsored by Betball. And if you do want to get involved and follow our predictions, which are better than we thought they would be, the link to download the app, if you are 18 plus and you are gambling aware, will be in the description of the podcast. But moving on to today's episode, let me introduce my guests. And we have a lesser team in terms of numbers, but a more powerful Squawker Talker panel, I believe, today. Firstly, introducing Rich, content editor at Squawker, Sam Long. Welcome.
How's it going?
Good. I'm really pleased with those predictions, are you not?
Getting closer, aren't we?
When you came in and dropped that we were 3 out of 4, I was quite excited. The fact that I preface every prediction saying that don't follow it, now it's going to be dangerous because perhaps we do know exactly what we're talking about. And someone else that we've pulled in that knows exactly what they're talking about is social media guru at Squawker, Tom Green. Welcome back.
It's good to be back. You're going to get 4 out of 4 on the predictions this week because I'm here.
So. Exactly. Big talk. And also, please, we're not guaranteeing 4 out of 4. I do want to make that clear.
Yeah, it was just a joke.
But we will get stuck straight into things. And as always, I'm going to pick only one place to start, and that is the North London Derby, the last game of the weekend again. And before we actually get into the game, I think Maurizio Pochettino has been saying some interesting things of late, and we're going to talk about the Spurs situation in general first. His quote that is going around, the most popular one at the moment, if popular is the right term to use, "I think this is my 6th season and the most unsettled group we are working with. That is why we relax and calm. Some situations we cannot fix. Nothing to say about that. Situations that are going on in the squad, still, we need to wait." Obviously, Sam, he's referencing the fact that the European transfer window is still open and there are plenty of players in that Spurs squad that have been subject of interest this summer and in the past. And you almost forget 6th season. Wow, that's quite a long time. So the fact that maybe a new cycle is beginning is quite scary. After that combination of reaching a Champions League final, people thought that would finally be the start, but it looks like things are going maybe back down again. What's your reading of those quotes and that situation going on at Spurs at the moment?
Well, he's definitely cut a really frustrated figure with the media, but that's nothing new, really. It's no surprise. He's always been a bit prickly. He likes to play the game. And as you say, they've definitely been stung perhaps more than some of the other teams in the league, given that the likes of Ericsson's future is up in the air, and they've got several fringe players who they're still open, looking to sell and open to offers for. And just by the nature of Pochettino's pre-season, that's going to be frustrating him. It's a really tough fitness regime that he goes through, but it's looking really fractured with so many players sort of umming and ahhing about whether they're going to still be there. And I think, you touched on then potentially going down. I think he's facing a new challenge this season, that the core of his key players is changing. There hasn't been a huge amount of movement in his team during his time at Spurs, if you think of the spine of the team. And it seems that some of those key voices that he's always had in the dressing room, perhaps not as united as they once were. So it's on him to rebuild the team, really freshen things up and evolve. It certainly felt like it's a bit stale, even dating back towards the end of last season. The Champions League run perhaps papered over some of the cracks. So yes, it's a new challenge for him. As all managers have to do, they have to make sure their teams evolve. And I always thought that Pochettino would leave Spurs on a high, with his stock really high. And there's just a sense coming through that if he doesn't quite crack it this season, then he could be leaving on a downer, which a couple of seasons ago you would have thought would have been unthinkable. Yeah.
And your point about evolving is something that we always praise Maurizio Pochettino for on this podcast, is the fact that he's actually changed his team every season. When it started, it was Walker and Rose, the flying fullbacks. Then he was one of the first managers that was using the diamond to counterattack the possession team and inviting the press. Harry Kane's role himself has changed so much. The centre-back pairings have changed. And the major thing that has gone sort of under the radar is people saying, oh, on the outside, off the pitch, Pochettino looks a bit glum. There's these negative conversations. People, after last week's defeat to Newcastle, started realising that it's been pretty bad on the pitch in 2019. Yeah. And just picking up the stuff here, 9 wins in 2019 compared to Manchester City of the most 19. So if they're considering themselves as a title challenger, they're 10 wins off that. Liverpool 16, Arsenal 12, Crystal Palace 10, Manchester United 10, who we say aren't doing very well, Chelsea 9, Newcastle 9, Everton 9, and Spurs 9. And then it gets worse. Obviously, they're travelling to the Emirates for the next game. So away wins in 2019, they have 2 Spurs.
Not good.
It's not good. and again, we praising Pochettino as a manager.
But also, I think he's always praised for his man of management and putting his arm around a player's shoulder. But then also what he does is he's very ruthless. So if a player disagrees with him, then it's pretty much out the door. The example I always think of is Bentaleb, who was played for him in his first season and was sort of being hailed as potentially being a Spurs player for several years. And as soon as he crossed paths with Pochettino, that was it. He was gone. Whereas now he's having to go back on his principles. So you think of Rose, early in the summer it was, right, he's not in the squad because he's going to go, and he's brought him back in. He's never really had to do that before, and he's having to do that with Eriksen as well, really, because the question is, should he play him or should he not play him?
That's actually a really good point, I think. The first time Pochettino hasn't been allowed to be his ruthless self, and this is where the conflict about Daniel leaving. I think with the stuff going on with Bury and Bolton at the moment, which is obviously huge news, and there's been plenty discovered about that, and people know more about that situation than we do. So the one thing that did pop up from that was a list of sort of like profit from 2017, all 92 clubs. Tottenham were, I think, at the top, or one of the top teams, because the model that they've done has been used to actually make money. Now there is a conflict because it's becoming harder to do that. And also Pochettino, because it's been harder to do that, that has now limited Pochettino in addressing his squad issues the way he likes to address them. And now you've got that, as he said, the unsettled nature, because he knows there's people that don't want to be at the club, but they're still having to be there because they don't have anyone else. So now there's that real conflict. And as you said, the major one is Christian Eriksen, who I don't think has started a game yet in the Premier League, or at least so has come on in 2 of them. Certainly didn't start against Newcastle. And against Aston Villa, he came on and all of a sudden Spurs were good. So Tom, on this one, we tasked you with doing a bit of digging about whether you think really Christian Eriksen, one, should be sold if it's the right time, or if they have any choice. And the impact of, one, him not starting at the weekend potentially, but more beyond that, if he does leave, the impact on that Spurs squad in general. Did you find anything interesting?
Yeah, so it's obviously a really curious case surrounding Eriksen. He almost said after the Champions League final that, I want to leave, come and get me. And as of yet, no one's come. If we start off with the big stats being, since Eriksen joined Spurs in 2013, not only has he created the most chances out of any Premier League player in that time, he's also registered the most assists. Funny enough, referencing back to the North London Derby, second on both of those lists is Mesut Ozil. So we got Eriksen on 5-3-3, sorry, Ozil on 5-2-1, and then assists Eriksen on 60, Ozil on 52. But I actually also decided to look into how Tottenham fare with and without Eriksen. So I just want to give a shout out to Soccer Base on this one, because I got all of my win-loss stats from there. So funny enough, if we start with the numbers, on all competitions, Tottenham have played 333 games during the time that Eriksen has been there, and Eriksen has played 280 of them, so around 84% he's played, winning 153 of them, which is a win rate of about 54.6. He's then missed 53 games in which they have won 33, which is a slightly higher win rate of 62.3%. However, I just want to give a bit of information surrounding this number, given that a lot of the games that Eriksen has missed was lower tier cup games, such as FA Cup, League Cup, in which he was rested or not.
And which we know Pochettino doesn't care about anyway.
Yeah. There are often games against maybe League One, League Two sides that Tottenham were going to win anyway. So I wouldn't look too much into those numbers. But it is quite interesting that Tottenham do still have roughly the same win percentage, maybe even higher, with or without Eriksen. Again, not saying that.
I think the most interesting part of that, actually, is the fact that he's played 84% of all games since joining the club, which shows that ever since he joined and they signed him. And people forget that Eriksen is 27 years old. So he's not, it's not like he joined in his prime. He joined as a, from Ajax, as a young talent that they knew was going to be good. But he's extended. He's now in his prime. He's used this whole, these whole 5 years at Spurs.
I'd probably say when he joined Spurs, you were almost expecting him to then have another move to a high level. But Spurs have improved as he's improved.
Yeah, we, that's what we're saying. The evolution that we expected kept happening, and it was, Spurs are getting better. They've got a new player, bought in Son, bought in Lucas. Now they've got a fast attack that they never had before, counter-attacking wise. Eriksen's playing a deeper role. And as, and we mentioned before the stat about the fact he's got 10 assists in the last four Premier League seasons. David Beckham's the only other player to do that consecutively. So they have a really seriously talented creator, of which... And then we spoke about Lo Celso in another podcast, so I don't want to dive in too much about how they would replace him. But it's clear that Spurs, one, prefer playing with Eriksen. The 84% I think that you brought up there, Tom, suggests that. And without him, we've seen this season, they don't look as good. Against Aston Villa, Aston Villa obviously went ahead and were counter-attacking anyway. But until Eriksen came on, they were narrow. I mentioned Alan Shearer's analysis about that before. Eriksen's footballing brain seems to improve that Spurs side in terms of the spaces he picks up and knows how to manipulate. And as we know...
And his incredible ball.
Exactly. We talk about Kevin De Bruyne's crossing all the time. And Spurs fans, I think, have a sort of meme about Eriksen not being good at corners. But from open play and his crossing is, again, it's up there with the best in the league. So I think we're in agreement. I think, Sam, you've said it off air when we were talking about the topic that you think he should definitely play against Arsenal. Arsenal are, in fact, the team he's faced the most... and not scored against in all competitions. 11 games without a goal against Arsenal. It would be now absolutely poetic if he does start and does score against Arsenal.
Oh, you've jinxed it for Arsenal now.
Do you think he should be playing at the Emirates on Sunday?
Yeah, I think he should. He should play him, yeah. Pochettino should swallow his pride and put him in.
Do you think it's... Yeah, do you think it's the case of that pride, or do you think it's because he doesn't... I've seen some people suggesting that maybe Daniel Levy's being like, we've got a good offer here, Maurizio. If he gets injured, we lose 80 million sort of thing. So almost as it, Pochettino would happily keep Eriksen, but he, now he's, because there's the sort of area of doubt surrounding it. I mean, look at what happened to Sane.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say really without knowing what Eriksen's mindset is like, because from the outside, he would strike me as someone who wouldn't be... You know, dragging his feet in training. He's still going to be in there training well and giving his all, even if his future is not 100% clear. But perhaps the fact that he's not playing him suggests that a transfer could still be on the cards. And like you say, Spurs are perhaps worried that if he did play and got injured, then it would fall down. And then they'd be stuck with a player with 1 year left on his contract who is injured.
That's the major thing. We're talking about the Levy-nomics, I think people call it as well, is... They've run into an Arsenal situation in which one of their best players has got 1 year left, and now they're in that impasse.
With Levy, I think he's, the way he does his business has made it difficult for Pochettino to get rid of some of the dead water in his squad, if you want to call it that. So, like Victor Wanyama, if it's a difference between selling him for, I don't know, 8 mil or 6 mil, get rid of him for 6 mil. Don't wait. You don't. If it's having an unsettling effect on the squad, then they should have got rid of Wanyama 2 months ago. It shouldn't be 2 days before the deadline. You're still umming and ahhing whether you're going to sell him to Club Bruges.
Yeah.
Get him out of the door.
Well, they might get them in the Champions League. He might come back to haunt them. So if Eriksen's playing, that means, and we know Harry Kane's going to play, and the second topic of Spurs at the moment is that I think we speak about it every August, usually because he's never scored in it, but he's got his goals this time around. But come into some criticism again. And so before going into Harry Kane, let's just mention that in terms of assist to goal scorer combos in Premier League history, Ericsson to Kane has happened 18 times, and only four pairs have done that more often. Silva to Aguero, 19, which will continue, I imagine, this season as well. Anderton to Sheringham was 20, McManaman to Fowler was 20, and Lampard to Drogba, 24, which is an obscene number, considering they didn't seem to be together for actually that long. So Ericsson to Kane, of the fifth most common assist to score combo in Premier League history, one of them might be leaving now, and the other one, in his last 180 minutes, has had four touches in the opposition box, two shots, one big chance miss, and no shots on target. But he's on the verge of becoming the first player to score 10 goals in Premier League North London derbies. So you can't... Surely Kane plays and you want to play his most common partner in crime to actually have a chance of beating Arsenal, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting with Kane because... Really, you'd have expected him to come back firing on all cylinders this summer because it's the first summer for a while where he hasn't had an injury to get over or an international tournament to play in. So he should be coming back fresh. And he looks really... I mean, he looks trim. He looks like he's in good shape. But what he seems to be lacking is the sort of mental side. He still seems to be a couple seconds off the pace, which... It's been quite surprising, really, but I will always back Kane to get through those blips. And the next even if so, the chance he missed against Newcastle, if you stuck me in a freeze frame and said, "Will he score that chance?" I will always say yes, because I think he's that sort of player that he'll have been in training this week, flat out ready for when he does get that one
reproducing
chance,
reproducing that exact situation
exactly.
As well.
Yeah,
Tom, surely. Those stats I mentioned, Harry Kane plays, you probably wouldn't even back against him scoring against Arsenal, considering that record.
Yeah. And like you said, I think they need the Eriksen-Harry Kane combo to play. I think Eriksen adds that extra dimension to Tottenham. As you said, in the Aston Villa game, when he came on and completely changed the dimension of the game. And I think Kane just loves playing against Arsenal. I think he just gets riled up when he plays against Arsenal as well. There's all that backstory about how he used to be an Arsenal fan, got rejected by Arsenal, and then went to Tottenham, has become a club legend at Tottenham. So
the picture of him in his little kit with his red Freddie Lindberg streak or something. Maybe I've imagined more of it and embellished that a bit more than it is.
So I reckon he's already looking in the mirror every night, hyping himself up for the game.
Must score. He usually gets a penalty. I think I read on the Opta preview as well that Arsenal Spurs is no fixture has seen more penalties, and five of the last 14 goals have been penalties in this fixture. So he's obviously the penalty taker. We always say Harry Kane's one of the best penalty takers. So imagine he joins a list of elite players that have scored 10 Premier League goals against Arsenal. And might even become the first to do so in North London derby history. But enough of you two talking, and I've probably done enough of it already. Moving on to Arsenal quickly on this. And obviously, because we're on the new Thursday slot, we don't do as much review of the games anymore. But a subject of the discussion this week has really been about those tactics that Unai Emery deployed against Liverpool, in which was a comfortable victory at Anfield. Arsenal looks like a worse side, and I think that's what they are anyway against Liverpool. However, in seeing all the questions about why did Emery play like that and what he may be planning to do against Spurs, I stumbled across a really interesting pattern that I genuinely, as I said to you before we even started the podcast, I got quite excited about. And I think Unai Emery is low-key assembling a Crystal Palace tribute act away from home. But fans will obviously want to avoid that, the effect that has on Selhurst Park. I think Crystal Palace have not scored in their last three appearances at Selhurst Park, going out in the League Cup on penalties because of that. But away from home, there's evidence to suggest that it's a really, really good strategy, because in 2019, Palace obviously have wins against Arsenal themselves, recently Man United, and I think Man City actually was just in December 2018, but in that period. And in the Premier League in 2019, only Man City have scored more goals away from home than Crystal Palace. 27 for Man City, 22 for Palace. Arsenal have scored 11, half of Crystal Palace's. And only Man City have won more away games. I mentioned Spurs' awful record away from home. Arsenal's isn't great either. Man City have won 10 away games in 2019. Crystal Palace 7, which is huge. But this is where the actual link to why I think Emery is using that similar approach to away games is because the main target this summer, or the rumoured target, was Wilfried Zaha, or a player like Wilfried Zaha.
In that mould, yeah.
Zaha was one of the most devastating away players last season, or at least in 2019. Zaha scored 6 goals away from home in 2019. Ashley Barnes, who keeps coming up, Jamie Vardy, Sterling and Aguero all on 7 above him. So for a team that doesn't score a lot of goals, Wilfried Zaha is keeping up pace with the top goal scorers. And we know that Barnes is one of the top 3 goal scorers in 2019 overall anyway. And then away from home, deeper stats, Zaha had 66 touches inside the opposition box as a visiting player, which is only bettered by Sterling, Silva and Salah. And that's extremely good company to be keeping with in terms of a Crystal Palace team and touches inside the opposition box. Zaha breaking forward almost single-handedly. And away from home in 2019, the most dribbles completed, the most fouls won in the final third. And although they didn't get Wilfried Zaha, they actually bought his compatriot, Nicolas Pepe, who, as we saw against Liverpool, 7 dribbles completed, the most by an Arsenal player since Jack Wilshere was fit in 2018. So it's clear to me that Unai Emery, and the reports were that it was after Crystal Palace beat Arsenal that he said, I've got to get Zaha. Because I think to address Arsenal's woeful away form, he realised that they did not have the same control that they used to, or the same wingable, fluid style of we'll outscore you and defensive solidity. Well, we've never had defensive solidity, but solidity through keeping possession. Arsenal are quite chaotic at the moment. So it looks to me, with that 4-4-2 that he played, which is what Crystal Palace play, Zaha plus one, is Unai Emery is looking at that as the best way to earn points away from home this season. And as I said, obviously the game at the weekend is at the Emirates. This is where the balancing act comes in. You don't want to fall into the trap of repeating that when you're meant to be the dominant force. As I said, Selhurst Park, Crystal Palace's record there, is awful.
Yeah.
But away from home, Arsenal look like they're going to be adopting that approach. And they literally identified that they needed one player to do it. They didn't get Zaha, who, as I said, is topping all of those stats. Expect Nicolas Pepe this season to be exactly the same. We saw it the 7 take-ons against Liverpool. He ended the Van Dijk streak, which has obviously went down really well. So has clearly talent in that regard and is a very similar player to Zaha in what he offers the team. The final thing I wanted to note was that obviously Aubameyang is a very quick player and people think his extreme goal threat and on the break, you would expect that if you wanted to play a counter-attacking style, Aubameyang is a player that you would lean on. However, it's the ability to carry the ball, not just eat up yards when you're running, that is the most important, because Aubameyang this season has completed 0 out of 5 take-ons, which I know is a very small sample size, but 0 out of 5 means that you'd never really be able to rely on him as a player to carry the ball up the pitch. If you were punting it into the channel and he could maybe chase it, but Arsenal did not have a fast ball-carrying transitional threat that would allow Emery to, as I said, Crystal Palace tribute act. It's essentially just a counter-attacking transition style because Arsenal are so bad defensively that they need to be able to sit deeper to reduce all of those spaces and they need someone that can turn a deep block into an actual threatening counter-attack. And the person they had that closest to last season, Alex Iwobi, who wasn't as explosive, he was good in smaller spaces. Now they have Nicolas Pepe, expect to see him away from home. But they need to make sure they don't fall into the trap of relying on that at home. And against Spurs on Sunday will be the biggest test to see how committed or how obsessed Emery has become with this idea that they can just become a frightening counter-attacking team. Because you have Nicolas Pepe and Aubameyang up front, that's going to scare any team. And we've seen Spurs struggle with those deeper teams. They lost to Newcastle because of it. Aston Villa, they were struggling until Eriksen came on. So now the fear is, and I think the fear for Arsenal fans, is that Arsenal go into a home derby and set up like Crystal Palace. And I mean that in the nicest sense. Where did Crystal Palace finish last season? 12th?
Mid-table.
So there's clearly success in their thing. And their away record, as I said, is up there with literally Man City's only better. So Unai Emery has identified a good tactic away from home. Now it's going to be really interesting to see how he balances out at home. I personally would love to now see Aubameyang, Lacazette and Pepe all start and try and compete with Spurs.
Yeah, I'd say that's the way to go, because Spurs are looking like they're probably going to have to play a makeshift right back. So Foyt is injured. Walker Peters is a doubt. So potentially their only fit out and out right back will be Aurier, who obviously they're also trying to sell and listen to offers for. So again, it's another player who Pochettino is sitting there like, why am I having to play this guy? We should have sold him months ago. So it could be Sissoko or even Dier in there. Ooh. And so I'd probably lean towards it being Sissoko, but then that means in midfield with Ndombele potentially out as well, you could have a midfield with Dier and Winks in there. So not the most mobile at all. Facing Aubameyang, if I was Emery, then I'd be saying, let's attack Spurs' right flank, because that's where we can get some joy. Also, Davinson Sanchez for Spurs has been looking pretty shaky. If he starts, then alongside a makeshift right back, that's even worse news. Yeah. Because the other choice that Pochettino has got is to bring Vertonghen back in, who is another player who, by all accounts, he's fallen out with behind the scenes.
That's the one I find really bizarre, because Vertonghen is, for me, along with Laporte probably now, like the best left-footed centre-back in the Premier League, definitely, maybe contesting Europe. It was so good for them in their Champions League campaign. I thought it was just injury. But then there's you thought Alderweireld was going to be the one that wouldn't play.
I actually put Vertonghen in my fantasy at the beginning of the season because I thought Alderweireld would be the one, like you said, that...
So there we go. So if Unai Emery does get the tactics right, this is one of the best times to play Spurs, no? You've got the unsettled squad, but I think he's got to resist using his Crystal Palace tactics at home, and he needs to press the attack against the unsettled Spurs squad. So to round that up, because we've spent a long time on that North London derby, and we do want to move on to other things as well, we'll finish off with the predictions for this game and we'll do predictions for the rest of the Premier League games later on as well. But does anyone have any thoughts? After all that we've discussed, if everything goes the way that you think it will be, Eriksen's starting, Kane's looking to score.
I think it was going to be 2-1 to Spurs, but ooh, I think the game's going to turn on a red card. Obviously got really fiery last time at the Emirates with Ramsey on the bench, although Ramsey's not there now. I can see there being another red card.
Red card. And a 2-1. So despite two wins in 2019 away from home, they're going to make it 3. Tom?
I'm going full on score draw 2-2.
Yes. Now, he's not been on the Score Talk for a while, but you can tell he's Score Talk born and bred with a 2-2 prediction. I had 2-2 initially. And then I just, after I convinced, well, actually, I don't know why it convinced me that we'd win. I shouldn't say we, oops. The Crystal Palace tactic, as I said, is what we're going to use away from home. But I just thought that was a really interesting bit to explore. And I'll probably track closely now. So if we play Lacazette, Aubameyang and Pepe, as you said, Spurs' defence is looking a bit shaky, makeshift. I can see a 3-2 Arsenal win. Because I think there's always goals. Arsenal literally can't defend. I think Burnley outshot them at home before, and that was 2-1. And I just think with the extra quality, but also Pepe playing for Arsenal now, I think 3-2 is what we could see. But we move from North London, and after the break we'll be using Tom's expertise to talk about the Hammers. So, as I mentioned, we couldn't get Tom Green on the podcast without diving into what's going on at West Ham at the moment. A team that we discussed in previous podcasts as having one of the most potentially exciting attacking units assembled by Pellegrini in the summer. Haller obviously getting off the mark in the most recent win, which was the first Premier League win of the season, with an incredible display, pretty much showing everything that we thought he was good at, link-up play, winning plenty of headers, and most importantly, scoring 2 goals. But when we were asking Tom to analyse this and discussing what we should actually talk about with West Ham, a player that definitely flies extremely low under the radar is actually proving to be one of the most important players, not just this season already, but even beforehand. I think we've spoken about him before anyway, just in the office. And so, Tom, your task, I think, is what we pitted to you again this time, was to explain why on earth is Mikel Antonio's injury such horrific news for this West Ham team?
So, as many of you might have seen, Mikel Antonio got injured against Newport on Tuesday, which was initially thought to be a 3-week, 4-week injury, but is now looking to be like up to 6 weeks. And anyone who's watched West Ham this season would know that West Ham have played 3 good periods of football throughout the season, which was the first half against Man City. I know what you're going to say, Man City was obviously 5-0, but you've got to remember that at half-time, which was when Mikel Antonio was taken off, it was only 1-0, and Mikel Antonio's defensive duties were just highlighted in the fact that in the second half, we then went on to concede 4 goals. Second half against Brighton, which I'll expand on more in a second, and then the last 15 minutes against Watford, which obviously we scored 2 goals in and went on to win the game, which also happened to be that all 3 of these periods have one thing in common, which is the fact that Mikel Antonio played in all of them. So if I go back to the Brighton game, West Ham played away at Brighton with 4 up front, 1 striker, and then 3 sitting behind, which was Hernandez because Haller was injured, Fornals, Lanzini, and Snodgrass. None of which have any form of height and physicality. Obviously, they're all fantastic players, but like I was saying, I don't know if anyone listened or remembered at the beginning of the season when I was on the podcast.
Of course they listened.
West Ham aren't the sort of team to go to places like Watford away, Brighton away, and dominate possession. That's not to say that West Ham play a long ball style of football, but when playing away from home, the onus is often on the home team to have most of the possession and dictate the play, which means that when West Ham are attempting to get out or counter, they often maybe play a long ball or try and play it out. So against Brighton, who were playing a free back, which included Shane Duffy and Lewis Dunk, both of who are 6 foot plus, in the first half, West Ham just did nothing. Hernandez was isolated for large periods of the game. None of the players could really create anything. We just didn't do anything. Enter Mikel Antonio, who when he came on in the second half against Brighton, he just adds that extra dimension, that physicality, that pace, that ability to just run at defenders and make them scared, make them think twice. And let's face it, in terms of aerial abilities, Antonio is one of the best in the league.
Antonio is one of the, since he joined the club, is actually one of the top goal scorers in terms of headers.
Yeah,
as well. So, do you remember that? I think it was almost 2 seasons ago. Do you remember when his first 6 goals were like all headers?
Yeah.
And they were just like Tim Cahill impression.
Even against Watford on the weekend, Haller's first goal, Haller's second goal came from an Antonio header from the corner, which was saved by Foster for Haller to produce that sublime overhead kick.
So that's what I mean. Haller was, obviously, as I highlighted, I think he won 7 aerial duels at the weekend. But I actually watched a good video as well to get more about Haller's involvement on TIFO football, which highlighted the fact that for Frankfurt, Haller did a lot of things and West Ham in danger of sort of making him or reducing him to just one of those or spreading him too thin. So it sounds like Antonio is actually the perfect counterbalance and the sort of the Luka Jovic or the Rebic to the Haller had at Frankfurt. And without Antonio, just moving on from him, because it's clear from what you've said, as you said, I think the best point is you've had 3 periods of good football in which West Ham fans have been excited about what they've seen. Antonio has been playing all of it. And obviously to pull your hamstring in a game against Newport is just almost...
He's had hamstring problems before, isn't he?
He's had long periods out in the past.
Hamstring issues for someone that is so powerful as a runner.
Always explosive players,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. So it's almost you expect it to happen. And for it to happen when, as you said, he'd just been, again, establishing himself, it's almost like the Calvert-Lewin issue at Everton in the sense that they don't actually want to play him. but they keep finding themselves putting him up front because he's the only one that offers that certain package, and the ability when it back is against the wall, he seems to be the only one that offers an ability to hold the ball up. Because Calvert-Lewin, again, has been criticised, and I think in Everton's defeat to Villa, was criticised heavily for inability to finish. But it's sometimes, and we've discussed that before, that some players are just needed in the team, and Antonio, it seems to be needed in certain games for West Ham.
Especially away from home.
Especially from away from home. And again, we've done what I've done with Arsenal. West Ham aren't playing away from home this weekend, Tom, are they? They have Norwich at home, which is where the player that I wanted to pick out, West Ham, is where I think we'll expect to see him, West Ham, not miss Antonio, and we'll expect to see Manuel Lanzini continue his good start to the season. He's created 10 chances in the Premier League, which is only bettered by Trent Alexander-Arnold and Kevin De Bruyne. He also ranks in the top 10 for dribbles completed this season. And for someone that was injured for so long, we spoke about Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain on last week's podcast being a new signing for Liverpool. Lanzini looks to be even more important for West Ham, especially in these games where they will actually almost get away with using their technicians. We spoke about West Ham being exciting because they could potentially field Fornals, Anderson, Lanzini, Wilshere, and Declan Rice. Declan Rice is probably the most limited of all of those, but even he has shown glimpses that he's decent. That's a very attack-minded, a very creative, a very diminutive midfield. But against a team like Norwich, who we've seen, it could be the perfect time for West Ham to actually show the flair that Pellegrini's added to the side.
Yeah, so this one should be a really interesting test because, like I said, you kind of get a different... Well, you definitely get a different style of play home versus away. And the only real test West Ham have had at home was against Man City, who are, let's face it...
Yeah. You have to play like the away side almost.
Exactly, yeah. So hopefully on the weekend, there'll be a little more onus on West Ham having a lot more possession, being able to play it around and allowing these sorts of players like Fornals, Lanzini and Anderson to go out there and create. Hopefully Haller... Well, I'm pretty certain Haller will definitely play on the weekend. Obviously, he didn't play... I'm only referencing the fact that he didn't play against Brighton because he had an injury. So that'll be really interesting to see those three providing for Haller, which I've only seen at the Olympic Stadium once, which was in a pre-season friendly against Atletico Bilbao, in which Haller scored an own goal 5 minutes into the game.
Right. It wasn't that also the game that they then scored a really nice link-up play, or is that a different
friendly?
Exactly,
yes. Yeah. Two fantastic goals scored by West Ham in that game.
So that
one by Lanzini and one by potentially Haller, actually. Mm.
I think, yeah. And that's the West Ham we can expect to see against Norwich, who, in terms of chances created, the 10 chances created I mentioned, Lanzini is only bettered by De Bruyne and Arnold. Another person on 10 is Emi Buendia for Norwich, who is this all-action creative midfielder, Argentinian as well. So him and Lanzini is going to be really fun to watch at the London Stadium. And as you've said many a time, Tom, and we've almost said about Norwich, we've been nice about it, but they've not been great defensively, conceding a lot of goals, but it was because they're being expansive. West Ham, not great defensively,
look very
necessarily.
Shaky defensively. Very shaky.
So this, again, obviously at 3 p.m, so it will be a one to watch on Match of the Day. It looks to me like it's going to be another fun game. And this is something I just really love about the Premier League this season so far. There seems to be more fun teams than not at the moment, which is lending itself to some super exciting games that aren't even on telly, and just catching up with those games has been really fun. So I think we've covered all the West Ham major points you wanted to highlight there, Tom, in the sense that we might not see it against Norwich on Saturday, but the absence of Antonio is going to have an actual impact on West Ham's start of the season, especially away from home. But with all their little playmakers, all their little flair players back in the side against Norwich, what do we see the score being at London Stadium? Sam, do you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, I think Norwich are going to win 2-1. Sorry, Tom.
No Antonio, no party. But Pookie party.
Yeah.
Is it
Pookie,
because
of course,
that again?
Yeah. Going for the September record of, I think, 6 goals in the month. Oh, August. Sorry, yeah.
Don't get ahead of yourself. Yeah, Dzeko and... I can't remember. I think it's a long time ago.
Well, Sterling's also on for it, isn't
it? Yeah, so Pookie and Sterling wrestling for that. And West Ham is a team you want to play. if you want to look into break goal scoring records. Tom, what are you expecting?
No, I've got to back the boys. I'm going to go 3-2 West Ham.
3-2. So the games that we picked as the highlight are purely just chaos games. Because we've reversed our predictions and I've gone for 2-2 on this one. No. So it's quite funny. It's quite funny how we were both swayed by allegiances to just add an extra goal onto the base prediction, which is 2-2 for Squawk Talk. 1 week, we need to do the Bet Ball Accumulator of just all 2-2s and see if it pays off. I don't think it will. Now, the final section of the Premier League preview part of the Squawk Talk of Football podcast is a round off of all the rest of the games and predicting those. So we will dive straight into it and we will start with the early kickoff on Saturday, which is Southampton versus Manchester United. Sam, any thoughts on this one?
I think it's going to be 2-1 to United.
Ooh,
and they're going snap. To score a penalty.
They're going to score a penalty.
Yeah, I think Solskjaer will have been spending
it's going to be
all week planning his set-piece takers.
They're going to try and rebuild David De Gea's confidence by letting him take it. He's always he's good with his feet, I think. So 2-1 to Man United. And as I said, snap, that means that I also think 2-1 to Man United.
I'm actually going for 1-0 to Man United. I think this week they've just heads down, make sure they go there, get the result, and no more negativity surrounding it. Yeah. And for the love of God, if they do get a penalty, whoever steps up needs to score and end this stigma.
Yeah. An interesting little stat that I found in the Opta preview of this is that the home side pretty much never wins. In the last 15 games, only 3 home wins in this fixture. So we've all been very smart with that prediction, all by a 1-goal margin. Southampton, slow start under Hasenhüttl. Although Bufal, who completed the most take-ons in Europe last season, I think had a little cameo in the League Cup, and Southampton fans are a bit excited about what he can possibly do for this season. But enough on Southampton. We move to the 3 PMs, and Chelsea versus Sheffield United is the first one I have written down. More fun from Chelsea, Sam?
Yeah, I'm going for 3-2.
3-2?
5-goal thriller.
The Squawker Talker goals podcast this week. Tom, thoughts on Chelsea, Sheffield United?
2-1 to Chelsea. Again, I think just need to win your home games. So
I think I've put 3-1 because I just think Chelsea, I just think Mason Mount, the Statman Dave, who did our recent Frank Lampard's tactics video, picked out some really good stats from Mount and the fact that he's hitting the target as often as some of the most elite strikers in the division this season so far.
It was interesting as well. Tammy Abraham, I didn't realise his goal against Norwich was his first from outside the box, and he sort of credited it to Lampard encouraging him. Obviously, that was Lampard's sort of signature long range shooting.
Well, did you see the clip of him in training?
Oh, yeah. Absolute ping.
Yeah,
but I thought that was really that's a
That's why they hired Lampard, wasn't it?
To give that confidence, because
if Frank Lampard says you can score from outside the box, you're going to believe that you can score outside the box. And that's where the sort of cliche about having these managers that were club legends pays off. Obviously, sometimes in the tactics, and we're still seeing naive Chelsea defending, it doesn't. But for a player like Abraham, for a player like Mason Mount, who looks flowing with confidence.
I think what it's done with Mount and Abraham and the team, it's really taken the heat off Pulisic.
Yeah.
Because really, he was expected to be the sort of Hazard replacement, and he was going to be under a lot more pressure than those two to perform. So because the media has now got this fascination with Abraham and Mount, it's sort of allowing him a few more games to settle in.
And which he has shown glimpses of. I remember we highlighted his incredible turn of speed. So Pulisic, I imagine, will improve. Emerson as well, who is a feature of our most recent Squawker Scout video. I was blown away by looking at the stats, and it's, of course, it's a super small sample size, but someone that dominates that many metrics is clearly just being funneled the ball, and they could never do that on Marcus Alonso because he was literally a tree that they used to cross from the other side and for him to score goals. Now they've inverted it. They're using their left side as the most dominant side. And Emerson, who is only 25 as well, is absolutely loving it and leading loads of stats there.
Interesting that Sarri was after Emerson, wasn't he? Wanted to take him to Juventus.
But then he didn't play him for Chelsea. Sarri is this one of the strangest managers, I think. just because he didn't play Emerson because he felt Chelsea lacked height. But he clearly, obviously, then thought he was a good player. But he was just like, I can't have any more small players. So he played Marcus Alonso. Anyway, that is just, I don't want to dive too far into that. Unfortunate for Sheffield United, doing a 3-1 defeat. But I just see Chelsea having too much firepower with Mason Mount probably scoring again, I imagine. Next game I have is Crystal Palace at home to Aston Villa. So I've gone for a 1-0 Villa win.
Yeah, you just don't know what you're going to get with Palace. They were so bad against Sheffield United, and then they pull out a win against Old Trafford.
It's a week in the life of a Palace fan. You lose to Sheffield United, beat Man United, and then lose to Colchester.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. You get knocked out on penalties to Colchester. But this is the thing, is obviously at home, and I know against Sheffield United it was away from home. But they haven't scored in their last three games, even against Colchester United at home. So I can see something really, and I don't know what it is. As I said, the reason I've said about that Unai Emery template is that away from home, Crystal Palace and Roy Hodgson has absolutely nailed it in 2019, but they just look so bleak at home. They can't score. And I imagine Aston Villa, who obviously finally got that win, Jack Grealish finally ends his streak.
Gets his W.
Wesley getting on the score sheet as well will be a big confidence boost for those. So I can just see Crystal Palace's home form coming to spite them once again. So yeah, I went for 1-0. Villa.
I'm going 1-1.
1-1.
I'm going 0-0. I don't think either team will have enough to break each other down, but I think low-key, both teams will be happy with the point on the board.
Yeah. I nearly went for 0-0 as well, because I just think I can't see goals. But guess what next? Leicester-Bournemouth. Goals. I've gone for 3-2 on Leicester versus Bournemouth, because I just think Vardy's getting his scoring touch in. Brendan Rodgers actually has a 100% record against Bournemouth in the Premier League. So I expect that to continue. And they both look for channel strikers. They both try and push up. They both try and impose their game on another team. Bournemouth played really well against Manchester City and still conceded 3. So I can imagine a similar thing, but I think they have a goal threat. Harry Wilson probably going to score from 60 yards out this week. So I've gone for 3-2.
Yeah, I think 3-1. You touch on Vardy there. I think he's got 10 and 13 under Rodgers. Almost like a new lease in life. His decision to withdraw himself from the England camp has definitely proven to be the right one.
Yeah. You can't play for club and country on a diet of Red Bull. I think he has to save himself. So 3-2, 3-1.
I'll Patrick, go with 2-3
goals, 2-2.
Nah.
Default. We should have a little sound every time someone says 2-2 on Sport Talker. We'll look to implement that for the next one. The next 3 o'clock kickoff, Man City versus Brighton.
4-0 Man City.
Tom. I'll back Byron to score. I'll go with 3-1.
I've gone for 3-1 as well. Great minds think alike, Tom Green. I've just put my little note for this fixture is Sterling ... again. 3 p.m. Newcastle versus Watford.
Well, a few weeks ago, I'd say nailed on for Watford, but they've started pretty poorly.
Sarr got off the mark. Club record signing got off the record mark in the League Cup.
But I just think it'd be very Newcastle to follow up the Spurs game with disappointment. So I'm going
that because they're out of the League Cup.
Yeah, true. Yeah. So I think 2-1 Watford.
Double down on disappointment. Tom?
I think Watford need to get something from this game. I can't imagine a team going 4 games at the start of the season without winning. So.
One for the West Ham faithful.
It's interesting with Gracia, though. They're already sort of talking about him being under pressure.
And he was the one that changed the philosophy, wasn't it? He was the first Watford manager to get a new contract.
Those pozzos.
They're ruthless. So, Tom, what was yours?
But in terms of scoreline, I will go with 2-1 for Watford.
2-1 as well. I've gone for 0-0. I just think both attacks are struggling for confidence, despite, obviously, Watford getting a result in the League Cup. But I just think this will be... Newcastle defended so well against and Spurs. I imagine they'll do the same. I just can't see both teams breaking each other down. And then West Ham-Norwich, we had goals galore. Burnley versus Liverpool, again, is low-key exciting fixture as well, because you've got Barnes and Mane competing for that 2019 calendar year golden boot that exists for sure. If they win, Liverpool 13, first time ever they've won 13 league games in a row. Unlucky for some. Unlucky for the Reds, Sam?
No, I think 4-1. 4-1 to Liverpool.
Tom?
I'm going to go with 3-0 to Liverpool.
3-0.
Again, if you look at Burnley in the week, losing 3-1 at home to Sunderland in the Carabao Cup, probably not the best.
Sean Dyche as well, partying at Reading Festival. God,
what are we going to do with what Sean a guy. Dyche? I've gone for 3-1 because that is 13. And that's the games they're looking to go unbeaten. That's the extent of analysis on this podcast, is number patterns. And then we move on to Super Sunday, Everton versus Wolves. I've put down it's not going to be super at all, this game.
I've gone for 1-1.
1-1. Tom?
The battle of the best of the rest. Like you said, I don't think it'll be too interesting. Everton might be fatigued from their entertaining, yes, that's what I was looking for, game against Lincoln yesterday. And then obviously tonight, Wolves against Torino will probably be a fatiguing game for the Wolves players.
Well, it's the first real test for them, isn't it? Like Europa League and then a big away game.
Yeah, exactly. And Everton are notoriously really good at home recently, despite some criticism of their team. I've gone for 0-0 for that reason, because Wolves aren't going to impose some sort of incredible attacking threat. And Everton look a bit bleak still going forward, trying to balance that striker, but also have been defending well at home.
I've gone exactly the same as you for the exact same reasons. Oh, no.
Stop copying each other's notes.
We only need one of us on this podcast. Tom, unfortunately, you're not on next week. And then the final game is obviously Arsenal versus Spurs. And we've done that. So that is a wrap on Premier League predictions. The final part of this week's podcast will be inspired by your boy, YJC1, who wanted us to talk about Napoli specifically, and obviously the fact that the Maurizio Sarri derby is happening this weekend. So, as mentioned, the final part of today's Squawker Talk of Football podcast will be starting with a listener's question straight away. As I said, the Maurizio Sarri derby this weekend, but Maurizio Sarri will not actually be on the touchline because Juventus confirmed immediately that he would miss the first two games of the season in order to recover from pneumonia. So he won't be there, and maybe that's a good thing because you don't want the fanfare of... I know when he went to Juventus, Napoli released that video about how they said, "Oh, thank you very much, but now you are a traitor." It was quite playful, but it was the same way.
Underlying tone of "you're a traitor."
Yeah, you are dead to us. And it was a similar thing to Higuain when he left. So obviously he's still somehow at Juventus. So he's probably going to play. So it's the Sarri-Higuain derby. And your boy JC1, as I said, has asked us a question. And it was, do Napoli have any chance of winning at the weekend?
They've got a chance. It's a two-horse race after all. But yeah, Juve at home are pretty ridiculous. Unbeaten in Serie A on home turf last season. But they did lose four games towards the end of the season. Okay, it was partly to do with their Champions League involvement. But they're not invincible quite yet. They're not completely up to speed. And I do think Sarri's absence will have an impact given the attention to detail that he pays to tactics and preparation. For example, if you look at De Ligt, he said he didn't see it coming that he was dropped last week. So if Sarri hasn't been there this week, then he's, you know, what's his mindset going to be? Napoli started the season with a thriller against Fiorentina. Obviously, they need to be keeping it much tighter than that.
I think that game was dominated. Again, I never actually got the chance to watch it all back, but a lot of VAR controversies in that. So they may have even been lucky to win the game. Mm. But scoring goals is what Napoli want to be about.
So in last season's game away at Juve, they took the lead early through Mertens. I think it was the 10th minute. They went on to lose 3-1, but the game turned on a red card. Mm. So they've definitely got a chance. And it almost feels like they're playing this game for the whole of the league. Because if Juve steamroller Napoli, then it's going to be disheartening for everyone. It's almost like that if they can go and get a result, then everyone's going to take heart from, oh, Juventus do have chinks in their armour. They're not going to run away this league. Because if Juve do get their noses in front and open up a sort of 3-4 point lead early on, I can't see them being pegged back.
Yeah, I think you're going to think they've won 8 titles in a row. We're not going to... It's not
exactly. And before Christmas, the narrative of they're running away with it, 6-7 points clear, will be there.
I think Inter Milan will be watching this very closely as well. Obviously, Alexis Sanchez may be joining to watch it on the sofa with Lukaku. Inter Milan, impressive. Just quickly on them, not analysis of sort, but 4-0 win. Brozovic was incredible. Look at his stats from the game. He absolutely dominated. Lukaku getting on the score sheet and actually creating the most chances. So if they add Alexis Sanchez, then maybe Inter Milan will be, maybe it actually will be a title race this season. Because, as you said, Juventus 1-0 opening week in the opening game. Ronaldo 7 shots, no goals. One, again, I think was a really tight offside call.
That was chalked off. Yeah,
chalked off, which was super, super tight. So you can imagine him having some sort of say in this game. But as you said, Sam, Juventus don't... And we spoke about it in the sense that Sarri's got this huge pool of 24 midfielders to try and get in a team. And we know he's only ever going to want to play three. Mm. So really interesting to see how they actually set up against Napoli, whether De Ligt does come in, because he's only going to play two centre-backs. And Chiellini and Bonucci, as De Ligt said himself, were known as one of the most... powerful centre-back duos in Europe. One of
but
the
I mean, at the same time, he hasn't come to sit on the bench, is he? So it's only so long that he's going to be swallowing that before sort of... But, especially the comments when he joined, he said that working with Sarri was one of the key reasons.
Yeah.
It's almost but like something's gone wrong now.
But this is why I'm saying Sarri is a strange character.
You know the last team to beat Juventus in Serie A at home? Napoli. Two seasons ago.
Was that the Koulibaly winner?
Koulibaly
I remember that.
And I think Napoli have shown in their first game, and this might just be the FIFA Ultimate Team lover in me, but with that front three of Insigne, Callejon and Mertens all getting on the score sheet in that 4-3 thriller against Fiorentina, they've always got goals in them. They've always got pace in them, and they've always got goals in the break on them. So
Insigne was involved in all 4 goals. 2 goals and 2 assists. So I think I can't remember who said it. Someone referenced them as the Smurf squad because I think they are under all 5'9", which is Maurizio Sarri's worst nightmare, a 5'9" footballer, isn't it?
But on the flip side, you've got to say, including the pre-season friendly against Barcelona, Napoli have conceded 7 goals in their last 2 games. So whenever you go away to Juventus, defence always has to be on points.
Yeah.
But I think they've got it in them to score. And like we said, 2 seasons ago, they somehow managed to conjure up that 1-0 win. So you never know.
I think as well, Koulibaly mentioned there scoring a header. He won the most aerial duels in their opening game as well. So he might be looking to repeat exactly that. And I've headed the microphone in a motion again, which you can't see on an audio podcast. But moving on to Napoli just briefly as a team rather than that game. So we're saying that they have a very good chance of beating Juventus here. Something that I noticed from that first game is the fact that Ancelotti slightly changed formation. Under Sarri, obviously it was 4-3-3, and that's when Mertens was born as this centre forward. And that's where, as you mentioned, Tom, that front three became famous because they all played all the time. They each had a specific role and it worked wonders. Ancelotti comes in and goes to a 4-4-2. With Arkadiusz Milik, Polish striker, who, by the way, Poland have Lewandowski, Piontek and Milik as their strikers, which is almost like they've cloned the same player 3 times. But against Fiorentina, it wasn't a 4-3-3 as such or not set out, but it essentially was because it was a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-4-1-1 sort of thing. And it was Fabian Ruiz, who, if you missed, I think we mentioned before, he won the best player award at the under 21 European Championships for Spain. All action midfielder from Real Betis, the likes of Dani Ceballos and Lo Celso recently come from there. He was played in front of Alan and Zielinski, and that is a more exciting midfield balance than just playing 4-4-2. Obviously, this means that Milik is removed from the starting lineup, who is the only really different striker that they have. But this new formation opens up for Lozano. their latest signing, to fill more positions in the team. And Milik can then be thrown on if they're losing, perhaps, as sort of the target man to chase a winner and go to the 4-4-2. But despite playing the 4-4-2 in pre-season, Ancelotti all of a sudden, first game of the season, 4-2-3-1, and it seemed to work, at least in the goal-scoring front. So that's the one thing I'm going to look out for, is whether there's an actual transition to make Fabian Ruiz the most prominent player in the Napoli midfield. But it also is really interesting. We've spoken about that Napoli front three being really famous, always scoring, always reliable. They've just broken records to sign Hervin Lozano. Like De Ligt, he'll be expecting to play for the team that he's moved for.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think his comments as well when he signed were really nice to see, that he was just delighted. I think he said a club of this magnitude has put the money up for me. Obviously, sometimes in the past, people who go to Napoli, they see it almost as like a stepping stone, whereas he is clearly seeing it as the end game. And not only is he now Napoli's record signing, he's also the most expensive Mexican of all time. And I just wanted to go through some of the others.
Yes, please.
Might not be too aware of them. So everyone will know Jimenez to Wolves. But I'd be surprised if people remember this one, which was, so third on the list is Neri Castillo, who went from Olympiacos to Shakhtar for about 23 million euros in the summer of 2007, which is when Shakhtar pitched up with a lot of money and started to sign a lot of players. I think it's the same summer they bought Willian. And then next on the list is Tom's mate, Javier Hernandez, from Leverkusen to West Ham for 16 mil. And then fifth on the list is someone who moved this summer, which is Edson Álvarez, who went from Club America to Ajax. And obviously he scored in their Champions League playoff round, so he's gone some way to pan off his transfer fee already.
And replacing De Ligt, who made quite the name for himself, scoring important goals in the Champions League last season. So with Ajax back in it, maybe we'll see Edson Álvarez fly high like De Ligt. But just to focus on Lozano there, because that is an eclectic mix of names. Javier Hernandez, if you said he was one of the most expensive, you wouldn't have thought it was the West Ham transfer that did it for some reason.
Well, exactly. I looked it up. I think Man United only signed him for like 5 mil.
Yeah.
Because that's why quite a lot of the Mexican players, they don't go for huge money sometimes, because the Mexican clubs aren't in a position.
Yeah, directly from there. Whereas Lozano, and let's just say, by the way, I think his season was cut short through injury last season, his final season with PSV. But talk about consistency. In each of the last two Eredivisie seasons, I think there was only 200 minutes difference, played about 2,500, 17 goals, 8 assists. Pretty nice turnaround. And as we remember, tore Germany to shreds in the World Cup, living up to his nickname, Chucky, as a scary sort of figure.
Scored against Spurs as well last season.
Yes, and I picked Lozano out last season in our Champions League preview podcast, which will be coming soon this year, as the young player to look out for. And it turned out that it was actually Ajax that were the team for the Eredivisie that everyone should be looking for. PSV struggled to get out of that Spurs group. But Lozano is someone I'm super excited to watch. And finally, look out for his replacement. PSV have signed Ritsu Doan from Groningen. We know what happens when you buy players from Groningen. Van Dijk, Dusan Tadic, Luis Suarez, Iron Robin. Watch out for him. He's a different sort of player, left-footed, similar to Robin in the sense he wants to cut in. But there's so many exciting players to watch. And Napoli have one of them. And Lozano can play any of those roles. Mertens, as we said, developed into that centre-forward false nine. Lozano can play there. I think he played up front for Mexico alongside someone, but can play there. Obviously, will love playing on the left wing with his cutting in on his right foot, but can play as the orthodox Cahill winger as well. So Napoli are going to be super exciting.
And like I said, watch out on Ultimate Team next year for Lozano's addition to that front, attack force.
Any Ultimate Team fans, you're going to be spoiled for choice in terms of Napoli chemistry this season. But also, we're going to be spoiled for choice, hopefully, in a Serie A title race with Napoli making a claim. And they can start that with, we're saying, it could be a win for against Juventus at home, ending the streak. But we don't have time to fully go into that, as that will be wrapping up this week's podcast. So As I said, we had fewer guests, but they packed a serious punch. So thank you, Sam, for joining us this week.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, Tom, for coming back.
Brilliant, as
always. Giving the West Ham knowledge. And remember, we'll be putting some of those predictions we mentioned into a Bet Ball accumulator later this week. All you need to do is download the app and follow Squawker Football on Bet Ball, and you'll be able to see if we can do even better than we did last week. Because, just to remind you, we did really well.